This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Roland Hoffman. Very much looking forward to talking to an old colleague of mine, someone who's made an outstanding contribution to the field of nutrition, because he is the author of a momentous, comprehensive textbook, the textbook of nutritional medicine. It's a very, very lengthy tome, a textbook, which discusses hundreds of nutritional therapies that can be used as effective, low-cost, low-risk alternatives or adjuncts to conventional medicine. He is a true pioneer in the field of integrative medicine, and I've known him for virtually my entire medical career. He's Dr. Alan Gaby. Dr. Gaby received his undergraduate degree from Yale University, got an MS in biochemistry from Emory, and an MD from the University of Maryland, practiced in the Baltimore region for many years, and he has many accolades, many publications. He has also and continues to be contributing medical editor for the Townsend Letter for Doctors, where he writes an outstanding column. And just on a personal level, let me just share that Dr. Gaby has been an inspiration to me in my career. Because true story, when I was a medical student in the 1980s, I bought a car because I hated taking the subway. It took me 2 hours to get to med school from downtown Manhattan up to the Bronx where I went to med school. And when you drive in Manhattan, it's always a gamble, and you often get caught in momentous traffic jams. But I didn't care because I had just purchased the Wright Gaby tapes. These were cassette tapes that were comprehensive discussions of nutritional issues that gave me my first grounding in nutritional medicine. So I owe Dr. Gaby a real debt of gratitude because he got me properly oriented to the science of nutrition when the opportunities in med school were virtually absent. And I've been a great fan and follower of his, trust his advice and his interpretations of the nutritional literature. And that's what the book Nutritional Medicine is about. So we're going to talk about nutritional medicine. Alan, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine once again.
Thank you, Dr. Ron, and thank you for that nice intro. The only part I didn't like was an old colleague.
Oh, okay. Well, a youthful
young, a young old colleague.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll get to your personal regimen for staying young. That's on the agenda. But I want to talk a little bit about nutritional medicine, the second edition of nutritional medicine, because I have the book in my office. I turn to it frequently when I write articles. I reference it liberally. And now there's a second edition. So how many years did it take for you to write the original version of nutritional medicine, and what does it consist of?
Well, I got interested in 1973 in this field, and I began collecting research articles, and over a period of 30-some years, I summarized them, categorized them, and practiced for 19 years during that time to get an idea both from personal experience and reviewing the research, what works, what doesn't, what you have to watch out for, drug interactions, etc. So I guess the process was about 30 years writing the original nutritional medicine book. And it's been well received both by the medical community, well, let's say the so-called alternative medical community, and groups like naturopaths and chiropractors and some dietitians. And a lot of lay people have used it as a reference. So I decided that you got to stay current. So I stayed up with the research literature over the past 6 years and made tweaks and modifications throughout the book. So the second edition is about 10% new, 90% old, and, you know, for those who feel it's important to stay current, I recommend it.
Indeed. There are 1,700 new references, and I think the book consists of, if I'm reading correctly, of 28,000 individually chosen medical journal articles. It's truly a labor of love for you that really kind of summarizes your entire medical career. But what significant changes are there from the first edition to the new revised second edition? Did you change your mind on anything, or have there been new developments that just weren't available when you first wrote it?
Well, mostly I've stayed consistent. I mean, the concept that you can use dietary modifications and nutritional supplements to prevent and treat hundreds of different conditions has been strengthened. I mean, some of the research before, maybe they didn't have a placebo-controlled trial. Now they do. So sometimes I would say the same thing, but now there's firmer evidence to support it. There has not been anything that we said, oops, we shouldn't have been saying this for the past 10 years. What is exciting?
No recalls. In other words,
no recalls. That
exactly.
Great
dangerous.
To recall a
exactly. Please tear out and destroy pages 493 to 498 because the advice that we gave there might be dangerous. You know, just like a drug recall. That didn't happen.
And things do change to some extent. We found out an interesting tidbit, which probably isn't of great interest to the average person, because most people are not taking massive doses of biotin, a B vitamin.
Yep.
But what was discovered recently is if you're taking a large dose of biotin, some people do so for diabetes, others do so for multiple sclerosis, you actually interfere with some very important lab tests, and you can make a very important erroneous diagnosis of thyroid disease that's not even there. So that's one new thing that came out that we need to know. An exciting therapy that came out a couple years ago was the use of vitamin B3, niacinamide, to prevent skin cancer in high-risk people.
Yes, very important.
The so-called basal cell and squamous cell, not the fatal melanoma kind, but the other two very common skin cancers, you can reduce the incidence in high-risk people by about 25% just from taking a moderate dose of vitamin B3.
Yeah, I think the amount was something like 1,500 milligrams, or is it less? I'm not even
500
sure.
Once or twice a day, I think, is what they use. And this was actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is considered one of the most prestigious journals. There's a funny thing that happens, though, because a lot of conventional doctors will just skip over that. They're not interested in nutrition.
Right.
The good part is, you know, you've been doing this since the 80s. I started a little bit before that. There are more and more practitioners getting interested in this field, and I think it's crucial to save our health and save our health care to start doing these low-cost, low-risk interventions.
Well, in a way, you know, when you first started compiling these articles, it was kind of innovative because alternative medicine used to be a little more of a seat-of-the-pants enterprise. There were naturopaths who would make potions and herbal concoctions, and it was almost like some sort of legacy or heirloom of traditional medicine. And I think what your efforts have done and others who've emulated you has positioned this in the realm of real science, because no longer can doctors say to their patients, well, there are no studies. You know, it can't be that good because there are no studies. And people can point to your huge tome and say, are you kidding? this is a legitimate
Just
field.
Just to correct the record, there are 17,000 references. I took those 17,000 from a larger list of 28,000, which is what you mentioned.
But some of them ended up on the cutting room floor.
Probably 3,000 or 4,000 of those are double-blind, placebo-controlled trials, which are considered the best level of evidence that you can get in medical science. Some of them are not, but, you know, I mean, how many double-blind studies are there that say you can cure dehydration by drinking water? Some obvious things, you know, if you're a good observer. So if I have to choose between a very, very well-documented treatment that produces modest improvement and can be dangerous and expensive, or a somewhat less well-documented treatment that does not have side effects and is not expensive, I'm obviously going to go first with the less well-documented one. So for that reason, I included both the very good research, the double-blind research, and studies that might not be considered the best of evidence, because I tried many of them in practice, and patients come back and say, yeah, it worked just like it said in that article.
Indeed. And you also comment, I think, on the strength of the evidence in the articles when you cite them, so that people can weigh them in terms of their validity and whether they are strong evidence or just perhaps partial or anecdotal.
Yes, and for some people that's important, and for others they just want to try something safe and inexpensive first, and they don't care how good or weak the evidence is.
Okay, so here comes the big question. You know, you've had a long and illustrious career, and looking over your career of over 3 decades, similar to mine, perhaps, you know, you got an earlier start than I did, what themes that you first highlighted when you were getting into this field in the 70s and 80s are you really proud of, that have really panned out, have stood the test of time, and have demonstrated that you really were ahead of the curve?
Well, I don't know if I was ahead of the curve. I learned most of this from others. I think I was out there promoting it, and I was trying to show where the science is so that other people can move forward. But the earliest things, clear out the sugar from your diet, identify hidden food allergies, supplement with magnesium and B vitamins, basic, simple things like that. Low doses of thyroid hormone, I've used that a lot in people whose lab tests said they don't need it, but in fact, from a clinical standpoint, they really did. And
so the natural thyroid
benefits in their
even sometimes
the
violating the guidelines of the Endocrinological Society, the guardians of the TSH. You actually kind of were a pioneer in advocating for a trial of safe low dose natural thyroid. Within reason.
Well, I wrote about that a lot. I learned it from a doctor named Barnes who wrote a book on it. But I treated probably 1,500 patients over the years who were laboratory normal, but who clearly had clinical hypothyroidism. And if I look back at my 50 greatest cases, I'd say at least 10 of them are thyroid hormone when people were thought by lab tests not to need it. The one other area which I'm excited about is I learned about intravenous nutrients way back in the late 70s and early 80s. There was a doctor in my town named John Myers, and when he passed away, his patients came over and they knew I was open-minded nutritionally, and they said, these are these intravenous therapies that I've been getting, and they all had amazing stories about how it helped them. So I worked with it and modified it, discovered that it is dramatically effective for things like knocking out acute asthma attacks in a minute or two, knocking out acute migraines in a minute or two, saving people's lives who have congestive heart failure. And so I wrote about that a lot and talked about it at seminars, and I'm happy to say that thousands of physicians in this country are using intravenous therapy, and they're using it to great success.
Indeed. And you wrote a pioneering article on the subject I have in front of me, Intravenous Nutrient Therapy, the Myers Cocktail, 2002. So you envision that as a promising therapy. And, of course, that's a therapy that I've used hundreds, if not thousands of times, with great effectiveness in patients with the aforementioned conditions, patients with fatigue, fibromyalgia, migraines, asthma, colds, and, of course, cardiovascular problems. So really that was the early foundation for what has become a mainstream tool in the arsenal of nutritionally oriented physicians, the intravenous Myers cocktail, so-called. When it comes to thyroid, do you feel gratified? Because recently there was an article in a mainstream journal, I don't recall which suggests that a very high percentage of people who take synthetic thyroid, Synthroid, or levothyroxine, don't hit the goal when it comes to well-being. They're left high and dry in terms of well-being, and that's something you could have predicted when you were talking about this in the 70s and 80s.
Well, we knew this. It was obvious, because if you listen to their patients, they said, I used to be on thyroid glandular product, the prescription kind, and I felt great. And then my doctor told me it's obsolete and made me take Synthroid, and I've been feeling horrible ever since. I heard that so many times. So, you know, you can be an academician and say it's not possible, but when you see it happening in your practice, yeah. As far as being gratified, I'm hoping with older age that I do things because it's the right thing to do, and if good things happen, that's great, and if not, at least I did my best.
Indeed, indeed.
Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. When it comes to allergies, you mentioned the role of food allergies or food intolerances. Maybe allergy isn't the right word because some of these reactions aren't true allergic reactions. You highlighted the role of allergies early on, but in your writings, you've been a little bit skeptical about the role of certain allergy tests, blood tests, skin tests, and you seem to favor more a trial of an elimination diet, correct?
Yeah, that's true. I probably put about 2,000 people through elimination and re-challenge. Just for your listeners, what we're talking about is hidden food allergy, not the kind where you eat a peanut and your throat closes up. This is more migraines, irritable bowel syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, some other conditions like that. People are not aware of the particular foods that they're reacting to, so you got to clear all the common allergens out at the same time, see if the symptoms disappear. More often than not, they do. And then you put one food back at a time, and you get a rapid and exaggerated reaction, and then you've diagnosed your own reactions that way. So elimination and rechallenge with about 2,000 patients, I found it to be very effective. The research on blood testing is all over the map, and I'm not convinced that it's accurate enough. Many practitioners will say, well, it gets my patient motivated to go on a diet, and then they do it and they get better. And that's fine, but
it's a teachable moment when you show people lab results sometimes. So some people are big into testing.
My concern is if you're showing them wrong results, how much good is that? But yeah, I mean, there are many practitioners who use it and they feel that it helps, and that's fine. I just like to do the one that doesn't cost anything and where they get these obvious reactions.
Yeah, I've gotten away from some of the blood tests, the popular blood tests. And partly it's because some of them are just not available in my wonderful state of New York, which has draconian laws against certain innovative tests. So there are specific instructions and directions for how one might undertake an elimination diet to discover if you have hidden food allergies
in the
book?
Yeah, there are. And I recommend this be done with medical supervision. In particular, people who have the potential for life-threatening reactions. Those would be mainly people with asthma and people with severe eczema. But in general, I like it to be medically supervised, at least by some healthcare practitioner who knows about it. It does not have to be a medical doctor. And the reason is we take out so many foods in the beginning that somebody has to teach the patient or the client what there is to eat. And typically we spent anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour in our first teaching session, and people were invited to call if they had questions or issues with it. It's about a six-week program, 3 weeks off the food, 3 weeks testing one food at a time, and you know, being available is very important. So it's doable. 80% of the people, maybe even more, who came in and I advised the elimination diet, 80% did it. Of that group, probably at least 75 or 80% found major food reactions that were contributing to long-term symptoms. So it's been estimated that as much as 50% of all chronic symptoms that are not adequately diagnosed or treated in a family doctor's office are due to these hidden food allergies. And if you're doing nutritional therapy, you can't be successful unless you're looking at hidden food allergies.
Another popular theme that you were into early on was Candida, the so-called yeast connection, which has kind of morphed over the decades into the concept of the microbiome and the importance of the relationship between gut flora, whether it be fungal species or bacterial species, even viruses, and overall well-being. Are you pleased to see that that's stood the test of time?
Well, I am, and I'm a little confused about the so-called dysbiosis, which is a term. I looked it up. Dys means difficult, and biosis is life, so it's like dysbiosis means hard life. What does that mean? But anyway, the concept is that abnormal microorganisms are living in the small intestine and possibly in the large intestine. I've kept a close eye on this as far as the research, and I do believe there's something involved, but there's not a lot of strong research to support it. And in my years of practice, I would use anti-yeast medication sometimes, and on very rare occasions I would use an antibiotic when I thought somebody had a problem down there. A lot of probiotics. Probiotics help to repopulate friendly organisms in the intestinal tract and in the genitourinary tract and elsewhere. However, I have to admit I don't really know what I'm doing, and I'm hoping to find some research that proves to me that other people know what they're doing too, above and beyond making some good guesses on the probiotics.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit like throwing darts at the dartboard at this point, because, you know, we still don't, in a lock-and-key fashion, understand how certain probiotics work to alleviate certain conditions. And it may be that it's different strokes for different folks, because some people have paradoxical reactions.
Yeah.
They get worse, while other people find it very beneficial. So it's a very complex subject that I think it's only in its infancy in terms of working out the formula. Another issue that you target in nutritional medicine and you spoke a lot about in the early years was the role of sugar as a potential culprit in many conditions, both physical and psychological conditions. And that, again, has...
And that's widely accepted now.
Very much so, yeah. So
the interesting thing is I came across some research recently that exposed the sugar industry back in the 1960s for paying some famous researchers to write a biased article that made sugar look good. And they got the whistle blown on. They got the Freedom of Information Act. They got all these documents that demonstrated that they were basically suppressing information about the harmful effect of sugar back in the 1960s.
Indeed. And I think you've been, on the diet front, you've been sort of a moderate, neither a vegan nor a fan of the ketogenic diet, but your recommendations have included adequate protein, but also lots of fresh plant-based foods. And that,
right,
I think, has been borne out by the research as well.
And there are different people who do well with different diets. I know plenty of vegans who are quite healthy, and the research does show that they have less of most of the common chronic diseases. But they have to be very aware of nutritional deficiencies. There are about 8 or 10 different nutrients that are often quite low on a vegan diet. So individualizing people's diet, I think, is appropriate. And I don't think there's any one diet for everybody.
Do you have faith in some of the new genetic testing schemes that purport to tell you whether you're genetically suited to be a vegan or an Eskimo, you know, based on some...
well, when you call it a scheme, I guess you're pushing for a certain kind of answer.
Well,
but, I would agree that...
I'm eliciting a response from you, and I think I know where you're going to come from.
I know. I don't think we have enough evidence yet based on genetic testing to know what somebody should be eating. There are some very minor genetic abnormalities that can be corrected with changes in nutrient intake. For example, there's a very common genetic abnormality of folic acid metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
But all you need to do is take a little bit of extra folic acid, and people are just jumping up and down. Oh, I have this genetic abnormality. I'm in big trouble. I have to take methylfolate. All these horrible things are going to happen. The evidence, in my opinion, is not there yet, and may never be there, to make firm recommendations based on this type of testing.
And don't pull any punches now. The blood type diet, what's your take on that?
Well, I wrote an editorial many years ago called Eat Right for Your Social Security Number.
Uh-oh.
And I listed four diets based on the remainder after you divide your Social Security number by four. All of the diets cut out sugar, three of them cut out wheat, three of them cut out dairy products. So you get the idea. It is possible to devise diets that a large percentage of people are going to improve on. And I wrote a book review of the blood type diet probably close to 20 years ago. And basically I agreed that many of the patients got better, but I found no evidence at all that it had anything to do with what their blood type was.
Yeah, there's certainly what's called a compliance effect. Is you tell people to eliminate, say, white food from their diet, and they invariably will get better. And there's also, there's some commonalities to these blood type diets. They generally eliminate junk, which is a prerequisite for wellness in any case. So,
That's true. And the question becomes whether it's whether it's okay to help somebody get better with a dietary approach that you don't believe is really reliable, but they believe in it. So a lot of times, if people say, I'm doing great on the blood type diet, I'll say, okay, well, that's good. Let's just make sure your diet is balanced. And I don't really see the need to argue with them.
It gives people, I think, some coherence, although it may not be fully backed by scientific evidence. That's
right.
I think,
When you were saying something before, it brought up a general concept. We're getting so much information from the internet and from the news, and journalists will just throw something out, and people have no way of understanding what's true and what's not. And there was just this one example that I thought of when you were speaking before. They showed that people who are pregnant, women who are pregnant who have high blood levels of folic acid, their children have adverse outcomes. From that, the journalist said folic acid is harmful during pregnancy.
Yeah.
But that has nothing to do with it, because we know that if you have this dysbiosis that we're talking about, small bowel overgrowth of bacteria, these bacteria manufacture folic acid, which gets into the body. So high blood level of folic acid is a marker for something else wrong with your body, and you can't blame the folic acid. We see these inappropriate leaps all the time, and that's probably the most gratifying thing in my work, is that I've had the stamina to wade through all this stuff and come up with what I believe to be a coherent analysis of some of these controversies.
And I think that's very much needed, because there's a tendency on one hand for journalists to use clickbait headlines sometimes to denounce the supplement industry and make fools of people who take supplements. But on the other hand, people who are true believers to write stuff that, frankly, is kind of outlandish about the potential for nutritional medicine to cure all and sundry conditions.
Agreed. Somewhere in the middle.
Okay, great. This is a good point at which to pause, because, as our listeners know, we divide our podcasts into two parts. And when we return, we're going to take a deeper dive into nutritional medicine. This is a wonderful textbook by today's guest, Dr. Alan Gaby. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.